Hi, this is Aliza Licht, and this is Leave Your Mark, the podcast, where I brew fresh career advice in conversation with some of my most inspiring and successful friends. It's professional advice that you can action immediately, whether you're just starting out in your career or well on your way. With a massive to-do list and a large cup of coffee, I promise that you can get it all done and still have time to post about it. So today I have a very special guest, Alexandra Carter. Welcome to Leave Your Mark.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here today.
For everyone listening, this is a real treat. This is going to be the episode that you probably play multiple times because it is going to be chock full of information. So if you don't know Alexandra Carter, she is the director of the Mediation Clinic at Columbia Law School, where she is also an award-winning professor and a world-renowned negotiation trainer for, wait for it, the United Nations. I'm going to let that land for a second. So I'm just going to repeat, literally the person who trains the UN in negotiation. And we are all so blessed because she has a new book out called Ask for More, 10 Questions to Negotiate Anything. Alexandra, you also serve as executive director of Stand Up Girls, helping tween girls develop relationships for greater self-esteem and resilience. I love that. You've appeared, of course, in media, CBS This Morning, MSNBC Live, Hardball, Marketplace, New York Times, Wall Street Journal. And I'm sure now with the book out, the list just goes on and on. And now here you are on Leave Your Mark, which obviously is a pinnacle of your career, clearly. So welcome. Before we get into the book, I want to hear a little bit about your background, where you grew up, sort of like what you were like as a kid, to give a little color to what you are now.
Sure. Okay. So I grew up, I was born in Brooklyn, first of all, which I think explains a lot, right? And I grew up in a town called Huntington on Long Island, New York. It's interesting. I think, you know, now I speak to so many audiences on a stage. You know, as a kid, I was more quiet. I think there was a period in my life when I struggled with self-confidence, whether it was making friends or knowing how to stand up for what I was worth. And it's really been kind of a lifelong process of coming to that moment, which is why it's so special to have a book coming out called Ask for More, because it really represents not just tools that can help people negotiate better, but it's also the story of one woman's personal journey to a place where she felt comfortable owning her worth and speaking her worth and teaching other people how to value her.
At what point in your sort of journey did you finally have that moment of actually feeling that worth? Like, what was that pivotal moment where you were like, you know what? I deserve this. I'm going to ask for it and I deserve it.
Yeah. So there's kind of a secret story behind the title of Ask for More. And the story is that I was negotiating my first salary and I went in wearing my best power suit, you know, and by this point, I would say that I was a young professional. I had become really great at advocating for other people and I was still struggling to find words and advocate for myself. And I've heard from a lot of young women that they feel the same way. So I go in for this first salary negotiation. I've got my power suit on. I'm ready to go. Super nervous. I get in the room and I had kind of an expectation for where I thought they would come in. And they came in above.
So never happens.
Never happens. So I kept my expression neutral and I wrote it down and I said, thank you so much. I'm going to go run these numbers and I'll come back to you. So I walked out and I called a senior woman in my field. And I said, listen, can I just ask for some advice? I'm not sure what to do here. They came in above. And she said, okay, Alex, are you ready? I'm going to tell you what you do. And I said, great. And she said, you're going to ask for more. And I said, I'm going to ask for more. And she said, yes, because when you teach someone how to value you, you teach him how to value all of us. And so if you're not going to go in and do it for yourself, I want you to go in and do it for the sisterhood. Do it for the women who are coming after you. And that was the moment I realized that actually standing up for myself was not a selfish act. It was the opposite. It paved the way. It let the ladder down for other women who were coming after, and it increased the size of the table so that other people could claim their seat. And since then, I have been passionate about telling women that when you claim your worth, you make space for us all.
That's an incredible story. And the one question that came to mind when I heard you say this is, you know, I am someone who, I mean, I think quickly and I'm very decisive in the moment. What stopped you in hearing that higher number from just saying, thank you so much, I accept? Like, how did you pause yourself to even be able to take that away? Because I know me, I probably would have been like, oh my God, I'm so excited. Thank you. You know, where do I sign?
You know, it's interesting. I think that in general, I'm the type of person who likes to take in information. You know, I think very quickly on my feet when I'm speaking and all of that. When I'm making decisions, I prefer to take a pause. You know, and in that moment, what actually stopped me was inexperience. It was the first time I'd negotiated a salary and I wasn't sure what to do. But I thought maybe the right thing to do was to take a moment before I came back and did anything. So in a way, it was just, well, I haven't done this before, so maybe I should figure out my strategy before I go ahead. And in general, I find claiming that time to yourself to really prioritize is super important. And that's actually part of what my book is about.
That's a great answer. So many people think, and actually, you know, when I was prepping for this interview, I also have thought this, that negotiation is really for like the ruthless deal makers, right? and it's not part of sort of everyday interaction. And certainly, you know, I'm a pretty outspoken person, but certainly if you're more of an introvert, it seems really daunting. Mm-hmm. How do you view negotiation and how does it become an everyday thing? And how does it sort of spill beyond sort of that reputation?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I too was taught that it was just this transactional back and forth over money. And nobody ever said this to me, but the message I absorbed was, guys do this better, you know, or you need to be really, like you said, aggressive and kind of sharky to be a great negotiator, which frankly was not my style. I'm much more of like a relationships person. And that's how I deal with people. You know, I prefer to be collaborative. And I thought, well, then I can't negotiate well. Then I went on my honeymoon to Hawaii and I got in a kayak and the guide said, negotiate your kayaks to the left so that we can end up on that beach. And that was the moment that I thought to myself, that's it. It's not about a back and forth over money. When you negotiate a kayak, you're steering. And over time, I came up with a definition of negotiation. These days, I tell people, it's any conversation in which you are steering a relationship. The fact is that relationships are the building blocks of everything. It's what makes, you know, the people who are in your home. It's also what ensures, you know, if you're a young woman starting out in whatever profession, your relationships are what are going to get you to the next level and beyond with clients, with people inside your company, with everyone. And when you think about steering relationships and kind of piloting those intentionally in your conversations, it's a game changer. It means that you don't wait for the money conversation. You don't wait until once a year to go into your boss and say, hi, I'm Alex, you know, keep me in mind when you're making your salary decisions. It means that you are teaching people to value you in every conversation you have. And when I made that shift, it was tremendously empowering for me because I realized there was a different way that I could be a great negotiator. I am great at steering my relationships, and that has been the building block of all of my success.
How do you teach people to value you every day?
Well, multiple ways. So one thing I like to do is I'm intentional about the way that I frame my experience. When I speak to people, right, it's not just numbers when you're teaching somebody how to value you. It's how you describe yourself. It's the words you use. It's how you paint a picture of your overall worth and your experience. This is something that is really near and dear to my heart because I can't tell you how many incredible, brilliant, accomplished women will downplay their accomplishments or will describe themselves in more timid terms. Let me give you an example. This is something that I haven't talked about on any other podcast, and it happened this week. So I'm a professor. I teach students who are in their 20s. So like some of your readership. Mm-hmm. So, you know, at the end of the school year, I put students up for prizes. And I was going to nominate a male student and a female student for prizes at my institution. I went to each one of them and I said, please write me a first draft of the nomination letter that I'm going to use describing your accomplishments. Okay. I get them back. The woman has written basically a bullet point list that's in effect just like this person showed up here. She was on this committee from this to this time. It looked almost like one of those neutral references that doesn't mean anything good. The man wrote, you know, I'll use a fake name. David has been pivotal in the operations of the clinic this year. He played a key role in doing this. He saved that. He went on and on. Here's the thing. The man was not inaccurate. He just described himself in the best possible terms, whereas the woman felt uncomfortable self-promoting. So I have to tell you, I called her up and I said, I'm going to send you his nomination. And I want you to look at these two things together. And then I want us to talk about how you can describe yourself in a way that is accurate, because what you have written is not accurate. It's a bullet point list. And I'm going to teach you this skill now, and you'll use it for the rest of your life.
Brilliant. Brilliant. I will tell you, hearing you speak, I realize that essentially what you're talking about having people value every day is what your personal brand stands for, right? Mm-hmm. And in my book, Leave Your Mark, I actually ask people to go through the exercise of writing their own bio. And essentially what he did, what David, fake David did, is really write a press release about himself as to why he should be nominated.
Mm-hmm. He told a story for the reader.
Yep.
You know, and I have to say that when somebody tells you a story, you remember it, right? Stories stick. Bullet point lists do much less. And a brand is a story. It's a journey of how somebody comes to be at that place in their life. And what it does is it connects with the listener and it takes the listener along on that journey and it inspires them to go on their own journey.
Such an important point. Such an important point. So talk to me about why you think internal self-awareness is one of the keys to negotiation.
Great question. Okay. Internal self-awareness. First of all, let's talk about what that is. When people talk about self-awareness, there are actually two kinds. And here I'm borrowing from the work of a fabulous woman, Dr. Tasha Urich, who's an organizational psychologist and studies leadership and negotiation proficiency. And she found two types of self-awareness. One is external. It means being aware of how we come across to others or how they are perceiving us. In the era of social media, I find that we have very high external self-awareness. We're thinking at all times, right? How are people perceiving me? Internal self-awareness is how well you know yourself, how well you can see inside, see in the mirror, and see yourself accurately. Your strengths, your areas of weakness, your needs, your concerns, your accomplishments. Internal self-awareness is the secret sauce that makes leaders and great negotiators. When you know who you are, you know how to go out and speak about yourself in a way that invites people to join you as a partner, whether personally or professionally.
Well, you just set me up perfectly for my next question, which I heard you talk about on another interview, and I thought this was brilliant. What is the difference between recruiting or requesting? Did you know I was going to go there?
100%. I have to tell you, I think this is my next book and you heard it here first. Okay.
Oh, great. I love it.
So what I was talking about, you know, and for the listeners, in my book, I give you questions that you can use to negotiate anything. And one of the powerful questions I would want every woman to ask herself is, how have I handled this successfully in the past? Inevitably, when we're facing a challenge, if we look back at a prior success, we can find tools we use that are going to make us successful here. So I was talking about the process of promoting a book. This is my first book. I've never done this before. And a lot of people have a lot more experience, but I thought, okay, I'm going to use my own material. How have I been successful in the past? And I remembered that I ran my husband's campaign for local office. And when I tell you I ran it, you know, mama plays to win. Okay. Like we beat the incumbent 2-1 running off the line. And here's how I did it. I didn't go out and ask people for their vote. I went out and I recruited people to join me on a team. I valued their expertise. And instead of saying, vote for us, I went out and said, help us make this message better. What do you have to contribute? What could we be doing more? You know, how would you like to participate along with us in this victory? And when I recruit rather than request, I create co-conspirators. I create people who are just as invested in the success of the mission as I do. And so for a book, what does that look like? It means I didn't go out and ask people for a sale. I went out to people 2 years ago and I said, help me make this message better. What can I do that would sharpen it? What stories do you have that you'd like me to include? And in the process of doing that, I created hundreds of people who then wanted to participate with me in this book's success. You know, so my message for women out there is always recruit, bring people onto your team. And when you do that, then everybody's voices will be amplified and you will go on to achieve so much more.
It's such an important lesson for any leader, any manager of a team at work, because it's true. You create passion among the group to be able to support the goal.
Yeah. You know, and if I could give a recent example as well, I also have a speaking business. So I do a lot of speaking and consulting. And a number of times, you know, an organization will reach out to me and first it's the gatekeeper, right? It's somebody who's just, they're not making the ultimate decision. You know, they're just chatting with you and then potentially they're going to pass you on. I think a lot of people make the mistake of treating that person like just the gatekeeper. Mm. But I never do that. Instead, when I talk to somebody, I ask them about their own goals. I ask them how they're doing at the organization, where they want to see themselves in a few years. Do you know that recently I met someone who was a gatekeeper at an organization and I asked her to tell me a little bit about herself and how things were going. And she said to me, you know, I'm so interested in what you do because I'm relatively new here and I still haven't figured out how to negotiate for myself and how to steer my relationships and claim my value and build capital here. So I took 15 minutes on the phone and I coached her. And then I sent her a digital copy of my book before it was released. Do you know that I recruited her? She, in the end, was like, this is so helpful to me. She ended up being my partner in bringing me in for a speaking engagement, even in the midst of coronavirus. So one powerful message is never treat somebody like just the pass-through. I would always, you know, serve that person, figure out how you can make a relationship there, and then you turn them into an ally and a friend of the deal.
That is exceptional advice, and I could not agree more. And I think people get so focused on their goal and what they're trying to get that they forget that human connection.
They do. And here's the thing. If you focus on what you can give rather than what you can get, I'm here to tell you that you're going to get more. Everything that I have gotten in my life has been because I never sell. I serve people with my whole heart. I give first. I give freely. I serve. And it all comes back to me. You know, when everything went down in March, on March 2nd, I went out to lunch with my literary agents and they were like, Alex, you're killing it. You got so many in-person events. You got a tour. You know, you got all this great stuff, right? And then all of that evaporated. All of it. My first book, everything. And I thought, okay, I have a choice. What am I going to do? And I decided that I was going to get out there and I was going to serve people. And so I created a series of totally free webinars, free, shareable. I didn't hide behind a paywall. I didn't upsell. I put my stuff out there and it was amazing. People attended. They called me. They said this was really high quality. Would you come in and do this for us privately? It increased the number of leads I got and the number of contracts I got during a crisis, leading with service. And so I think your point is so right that when your brand is about service, that is somebody that people want to be in partnership with, and you're going to attract so much more.
That's incredible. So here is actually a very relevant question that happened in my women's networking group today. Someone posed the question, are you charging differently for Zoom speaking engagements? Because everyone, you know, companies are saying they don't have the budget. So what is your opinion on negotiating something like a speaking engagement or negotiating anything right now? Is there sort of the pandemic discount?
It's a great question. The title of the book is Ask for More. So I'm here to tell you, when in doubt, I want to teach people how to value me. And so I put out a tremendous amount of free content. I am generous with it. I think people know that I'm someone they can pick up the phone and ask a question and I'm going to serve them, right? I'm not going to be like, I'm charging you for this, you know, 30 minutes of my time. But what I don't like to do really is to discount on speaking, because I want to be teaching people how to value me for the long haul. And I think it's all too easy, especially for us women, when times get tough, to be like, oh, it's not nice to ask for more now, right? And I really want to reframe that conversation in your head. Teach people how to value you. If you put out a proposal and people can't afford it, and it's an aligned client, you can make a decision then. But when in doubt, I would start by asking for more and knowing your worth.
Best practice. Do you throw out a number first, or do you wait for your opponent to tell you what their offer is or their budget is?
That's interesting. And I am so interested that you use the word opponent, because I want people to know that even if your adversary at the table, even if you're trying to, it's about money, right? And you're trying to get as much as possible and they're trying to save as much as possible. I always try to remember that the adversary is frequently my partner when the deal is done. For example, if we're negotiating for speaking, right? At the end of that, I'm partnering with that person. And I'm proud to say, I have never had a one-time client ever in my history of speaking. People always come back. And why is that? Because I remember that they're my partner throughout. So that's one interesting note. You know, here I would say I tend to like to throw out the first number, but what I try to do first is get as much information as possible from the other person, right? So about, you know, the type of client, the type of event, the number of people, the work that's required, what they need most, what their pressure points are, what I'd be looking to provide, because that then really feeds in to me thinking about how to value myself for that particular engagement. You know, and I'll be honest, I do a certain amount of paid speaking work. It's also really important to me to do a certain amount of public interest work. Mm-hmm. And so I don't have the same scale for everyone. And if I have an aligned group where I feel that I'm going to make a strong contribution, I have absolutely done lower cost or free speaking work because I see that as part of my mission. So in general, I do like to throw out the first number. I just try to do it with as much information as possible.
So the second follow-up question to that, and I don't know if you know Cindy Gallup, but she is pretty famous for saying, throw out the biggest number you can say out loud without laughing. And she teaches women this. So I'm curious what you think, even for like a new job opportunity, not just speaking engagements, because that's very specific, but how much higher should you aim when you're going for something like that?
Here's where I would say building networks is so important. I find it really important to have people that you can ask, right, to make sure that you are benchmarking yourself appropriately. And for me personally, you know, at various points in my life, and it's not so different actually for speaking engagements, I would call a senior woman and I would say, okay, what do the big guys charge? Because it's important for me to know, you know, what it is that's out there. I think a lot of times compensation is a black box. And so having those informal networks can really, really be helpful. I don't really subscribe to the theory of taking a number and then jacking it up some arbitrary number like 20%. What I like to do is there's research out there to show that your asks should be as follows. Optimistic, right? So putting forth the best case, like that gentleman did with his nomination. specific, right? So being very concrete and justifiable. So in other words, I don't just throw out a number that's 20% more. I think about how I can frame that number. What does that number mean? How have I tethered it to some version of reality that makes it easy for the person to understand why I have come up with that number? I do this all the time in negotiation when I'm helping people. You know, they'll say, well, my offer is this, and that represents a multiple of blank, or that represents X number of dollars for every, you know, party. So that type of thing. Find a way to justify it. Optimistic, specific, and justifiable.
I love it. I love it. So my personal experience with negotiation, and this is probably like I'm a bad student, is I always get a little nervous that I'm going to push it too far and that the person's going to walk away. So whenever I negotiate something, I'm aware, well, this is probably a good thing to do. I'm aware when I go into it that I'm happy to walk away if they're not going to play. But what is sort of the best practice for the back and forth of tossing that number around?
So you've said, you know, you're worried that you're going to push it too far. You know, may I just say, I still think this is a very gendered conversation. Okay. I think a lot of us women are worried about pushing it too far. I think men are much less concerned.
I think you're right.
Right. And I think this is because there's a tightrope, an invisible tightrope that we all walk as women, and it's very unfair. It's, you know, on the one side, you're too aggressive. On the other side, you're a good girl, you're a worker bee, you're not a leader. And so all of us feel like we are walking that tightrope and threading that needle. And there are pressures out there that exist like that. What I would say is, you know, there are two things you can communicate during that portion of negotiation. You can communicate numbers, and you can communicate messages. And so what I try to do is I pair my number with a message that lets people know that I'd like to work something out, right? So I'm really excited about the possibility for this collaboration. Here is the investment, right? And here's what this investment represents. And so when I'm going back and forth, I might say, listen, you know, if the person says absolutely not or whatever, although I find I get that much less than I would anticipate, right? The absolutely not, I'm going to get up and walk away from the table. You know, most of the time that fear in our heads is not going to come to materialize. Instead, somebody might say something like, well, that seems like it's going to be out of our budget. In which case I would say, okay, you know, tell me more. Because I'm looking for that person to share as much information as possible about what's happening. And I will say, the first time I ever negotiated for speaking work, I went in and I asked for what I knew was market rate. I'd done some research and they basically said, we can't do it. We went back and forth a couple rounds and then I maxed them out. And they said, this is the first time we're doing an event like this. And, you know, pretty much, unfortunately, we did the speaking later on in the procurement process. And so this is the budget we have. And I said, all right, so let's talk. Tell me more about the event. And I tried to get as much information as possible. And what we settled on was I spoke for them at the below market rate. I asked their professional photographer who was covering the event to take a bunch of professional photos of me speaking on stage with the company logo in the background. And I negotiated to have those for my future use. I put a value on that at a pretty significant amount, you know, brand photography. And then I said, and I'd like somebody who's very high placed in the organization to serve as a reference for me for future events. Who would that be? With the reference, with the photos, and with the money, I actually went on to earn a tremendous multiple from that one engagement in terms of referrals. So when in doubt, if you max out on the money, I would just say, all right, what else can we do to get this deal done?
So brilliant, Alex. Okay. In the book, you offer a framework for asking 10 powerful and courageous open questions. You call them mirror questions and window questions. What is a mirror question and what is a window question? And are we decorating a home right now?
I know. Well, so a little behind the scenes info. When I first sold this book, it was called Mirrors and Windows, you know, 10 questions to negotiate anything, before Simon and Schuster gently suggested to me that people would look for this book in the home improvement section, right? So They were very kind. They're like, Alex, you know, we love you. Your title sucks. Let's get another one.
Gotta love the sales focus group.
I know. But you know what? What can I say? I mean, I think Ask for More is a significantly better title, right?
Oh, it's gold.
It's killer. Okay. So mirror questions are where you are, as the word suggests, looking in the mirror. They are questions you ask yourself, right? And remember that self-awareness, you know, that's going to make us great leaders. That comes from asking yourself the right questions. So it's five questions that you could go through in under a half an hour for the first time. Or, you know, as you get better at it, these days I do it in 15 minutes and I create a plan that helps me enter any conversation with so much confidence. Window questions are what you do once you're in the room with somebody else. It gives you five great questions that you can ask anybody, whether it be a partner, a child, a parent, or a boss, or a potential client. And these questions I have found are the ones that are going to help you break through any negotiation and really, really be able to ask for more.
Oh, sounds like such a foolproof strategy. I'm so excited to share this episode and for people to read your book. What's the difference between focusing on the underlying problem rather than your desired solution? I've heard you say that.
So a lot of times when people come in for negotiation coaching or when they're sitting down themselves, they start by immediately going to the solution, especially during a crisis. So if you're a small business owner, right? I mean, you can't have a storefront right now. I've seen some small business owners say, okay, I'm just going to go and I'm going to post a bunch on social media, or I'm going to reach out to everybody who's in my Rolodex and try to get some new clients. And what I want to tell people is, whoa. What is the problem you're trying to solve? If you're thinking about like reaching out to your entire Rolodex, like what does that get you? Is the problem you're trying to solve, you're just trying to bring in cash flow of any kind into the business this month? Or are you trying to pivot your business and find the best strategic partners who are going to be with you for the long haul? Because in that case, you're not going to do a blitz. You're going to do a targeted outreach. When you define the problem you're looking to solve, you then can devise strategies to meet it. Even if you're going into your boss to ask for more money, for a raise, you know, I think sometimes people assume they can just go in and say, I'd like 20% more. But yet again, what is the problem you're trying to solve? Is it merely just that you want more cash coming in the door every month? Or are you trying to teach management how to value you? Are you trying to teach them to think of you as a leader? Are you trying to put yourself in position to be in management or in the C-suite someday? If so, it's really not just about money. And when you understand the problem you're trying to solve, then you're going to devise a more complete set of strategies to help you go in and achieve it.
I love it. How do fear and guilt kill negotiation?
So those are what I call the big two. They're the big two unexpressed emotions that kind of kill deals. A lot of us feel fear, you know, especially right now, I would say people are worried, you know, what's going to happen to me, my business. They're also feeling guilt. What more could I have done? Or why did I put myself in this terrible financial position? And this is something that, just on a personal note, I've been feeling a lot this week. You know, the day that my book came out, I woke up, I felt incredibly happy. And then I got a call that my father, who's already in hospice, dying of a brain disease, had contracted COVID.
I'm so sorry.
Thank you. Yeah. And was on morphine. And they said it was not looking good. And immediately I started going into the fear and the guilt, you know, the fear, like what is going to happen? And then the guilt, you know, I went to visit him in February. I should have gone again. I should have tried to go again before everything shut down. I think it's so natural for us to be in those two emotions. And very often when we experience those in a conversation with somebody else, it comes out as anger, right? So instead of admitting to yourself, right, that you're feeling fear or you're feeling guilt, you project defensiveness or whatever. And I found, imagine a situation where you're trying to give feedback to an employee, you know, and they get defensive. that's what they're feeling. They're feeling fear, what's going to happen to my job, and guilt, like, how could I have done better? So one thing that I do when people are experiencing that, I might first try reassuring them and saying, listen, I want you to know that this conversation is not a you're leaving the company conversation. This conversation is a how can we fix this one thing and give everybody absolutely no reason not to promote you. That's what this conversation is about. So reassurance and defining the problem to be solved. And when you're feeling those things, it's useful to write them down, journal them. When you write down those emotions, you actually release them, like the process of writing them down. And writing down specifically what I feared and felt guilty about was clarifying for me, because I realized, you know, my father was already dying. And so what do I fear most, if I'm being truthful? I fear that he's going to suffer. And so if he gets taken quickly by coronavirus, actually, my worst fear does not come true, because he's not going to suffer. He may go quickly. And when I think about my guilt that I visited him just a few weeks before the crisis, writing that down was clarifying for me, because I thought, you know what? I've been a great daughter. I did my best. If I get to see my dad again, like, great. And if not, I believe he knows that I love him and I did my best. So when you write those things down, it's really, really helpful. And I've found that from personal experience.
Wow, that's so powerful. Truly. I'm so sorry you had to go through that and your family. It's such a hard time for everyone. So obviously a lot of people have been laid off at this point. When people go back to work, there will be smaller teams, leaner teams, meaner teams. People will find themselves in the position of doing other people's work, right? Mm-hmm. They had their job before, and now maybe three people are gone. They're doing all of that. Is that a scenario where someone can ask for more, given the state of everything? And if so, how does someone approach that conversation?
Yeah, I still would. You know, I think there are a couple ways to look at it. One is, right, it's tough times and every dollar is precious. And another way to look at it is, it's tough times, every dollar is precious, and the company should put those dollars to the highest and best use. And I would be thinking about how it is that I, doing multiple jobs, am the best and highest use of the company's money. And I would make what I call an I, we ask. Here's what I'm requesting, and here's how we benefit. You know, promoting me, you know, giving me a raise, putting me into this position is going to enable me to meaningfully contribute to saving cash flow and helping us get out of this recession on the stronger side.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. What happens, as it sometimes does, when a negotiation gets ugly?
Okay. Can you say more what you mean by getting ugly?
Like, if, you know, someone becomes combative, or it becomes, I mean, obviously this is maybe less so in the workplace and more so maybe in the personal side of things, but like, if you're negotiating with someone and it becomes heated, how do you handle yourself?
Sure. So one of the things I talk about in the book, you know, it is about questions, but I also give people a strategy called summarizing. When you summarize, if somebody's getting heated and upset, the number one thing I do is not, but let me tell you my opinion. No, that's only going to make it worse. I listen to what they've said and I summarize it. So I'd be like, okay, so just to make sure. So what's upsetting you here is you feel the communication has not been productive. You were upset that it happened this way. You were also upset about this other thing. What did I miss? Right? And I summarize for them. And when I do that, it's magic. It's like letting the steam off the kettle, and I can watch somebody start to come down before my eyes. The other thing I can do is, you know, when people get upset, very often they're seeking acknowledgement. And so what I might do is find something that I can acknowledge them for. So let's say I've been in a heated negotiation with somebody for a while, and maybe they're talking over me. They haven't been the most productive. I'm not going to thank them for their civility, right? I'm not going to thank them for being so polite. But I could say, you know, I just want to acknowledge something. This has been a tough conversation. There's significant amounts that we don't agree on. And yet you're still here with me trying to work it out. And so I want to thank you for that commitment. And that tells me that we still have more work we can do together. when you summarize for people and find a way to acknowledge, I found that it very often takes the heat down. And for super unproductive behavior, okay, you know, so I've had people in negotiation. I mean, look, I'm with people in New York City courts, okay? So sometimes threats are just another day at the office. And I've had people in mediation when I'm trying to help them say, you know, I could taser him. And so when I get that, no, I mean, yeah, I could taser him. I mean, this is just, like I said, another day at the office for me. And my response to that is, you could taser him. How does that help you achieve your goals here today? Right?
With a straight face.
Absolutely, with a straight face. I mean, and the truth is that I have helped people through all sorts of scenarios where violence was an option that was put on the table. I once mediated a case between two women who were living in an apartment building in New York, and there had been increasing violence between them such that the police got involved and insisted they go to mediation. And they came in and they were talking candidly about the fact that they could harm each other seriously. You know, and one of them was like, I could kill her. And I was like, you absolutely could. And why don't we play through what happens when you do that? And instead of just saying how ridiculous or why would you do that, I engaged with it. And she thought, and she was like, well, if I kill her, I'm going to go to jail. And I was like, okay, and what else? And she goes, and I don't have any relatives to put my kids with. And so my kids go into foster care. And we played that whole thing out. And at the end of it, the women did not become best friends, but they shook hands and they agreed not to harm one another. And so truly, amazing. Right? Like, I find that a lot of times violence is born out of fear. And if I can help people like respect that fear and find another way to engage and ask them, how does that serve your goals? People are capable of calling forth their better angels to find another way.
Incredible. So in your vast experience, what are the mistakes that you see people making over and over again? I'm sure there's some common denominator here.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of times it comes down to a lack of self-awareness. I do think that the mirror section of this book is so critical. It should be foundational to everything you do in life, because the truth is, deciding what you want to do for your career, that's a negotiation. Figuring out, you know, sort of how you're going to allocate work responsibilities between you and your partner in the home, that's negotiation. You know, creating a warm and close relationship with my 9-year-old daughter, that's negotiation. And all of that, the foundation of all of that is being really aware of who you are, what you need, your emotions, and how you can move forward. And so I would say the mirror section is indispensable, especially during a crisis. Take a little bit of time to understand yourself and get to know yourself. That is the source of all of your power. As I've gotten more senior in life and in my career, it's that. It's how well I know myself that really has been the source of all of my achievement, all of my pride, and really all of my joy. Because when I know myself well, I make choices that are in alignment with that. And these days, I wake up every day to a life I love. I'm doing a job where I feel like I was born to do it. And I have relationships in my life that are serving me. And it all comes from looking in the mirror.
So would you recommend that when people buy the book, that they literally memorize those mirror questions?
Here's the thing. It's 5 questions, right? So it's not hard, I promise. And once you do it, they're going to stick with you. You know, I've had so many people say to me, Alex, I thought that reading this book was going to feel like I had to rearrange all the furniture in my brain. And I've discovered that actually it's just a tweak. It's just a slight adjustment that we make every day. The fact is we're asking ourselves questions all the time. It's just that most of the time we're asking the unhelpful ones. So this is going to give you 5 great questions that you can ask yourself that really are going to change your life.
Do you negotiate with your daughter?
All the time. Yes.
Do you ever lose?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, I would say I'll give you the most recent one. It's been over screen time in the home.
Oh, yeah. Big one. Big one.
And there, you know, instead of just saying like, that's it, I'm cutting it off, I sat down with her and I said, tell mommy really like what the screen time represents for you. And it was so interesting because one of the first answers she gave me was, it's one of the only ways I can connect with my friends during quarantine. Mm. And so that opened up a whole conversation where we could talk about what she was missing. She could share her feelings with me and we could work out a plan that would enable her to keep in touch with her friends and also would satisfy my concerns about making sure we were giving her brain breaks, you know, and also creating time for schoolwork. So really, I like to go beyond winning and losing. I find that most of the time we can create value, and that's what I seek to do.
Okay, I'm going to employ that a little later with my daughter. have you ever had a negotiation that you felt like you didn't handle it well, that you look back on now and you're like, wow, if I would have done X, then Y would have happened, like in your accomplished life now?
Yeah, I put it in the book. It was important to me to include in the book examples where I have shined and examples where I have fallen short. Because the truth is, I'm not calling down to people from the top of the mountain. I'm on the mountain with you. I'm a few steps ahead with my backpack on. And my goal is just to point out the rock that I tripped on so that you don't trip on it yourself. And I talked about a personal negotiation. It was, you know, a couple of years ago when my dad was first diagnosed and was declining, and there was a lot of fear and guilt on the part of me and my family members. And one of my family members asked a pretty innocent question about my dad's medications, and I exploded on him. And I did it because I was feeling so scared. I was in charge of my dad's medical care for the first time, and I felt like a kid, you know? I thought, am I really up to this? Have I done enough? The guilt, can I really do this? And so I really didn't handle it well. And later on, we ended up sitting down. And when I talked about my emotions, when instead of just exploding on this person, I said, let me be honest, I am scared. I don't know if I can curse on this podcast, but I
am. Yeah, of course you can.
Okay. I am scared shitless. Okay. My dad is dying. I don't know how to stop it. And he can't tell me he approves of your decisions. And so I need to hear that from you. When I had that conversation, it went so much better. And so, yes, I absolutely have had conversations that didn't go well. I come home and I have a lot of successes. I feel like I fail twice a week in my household, you know, in being a collaborative problem solver. But the difference with these tools is, you know, sometimes after I go out and I say the thing I shouldn't say, I'm able to recollect and, like, again, call on my resources and go back and say, you know what? I'm sorry. Let's try again. Here's what I meant to say the first time. So it's not about perfection. It never has been. It's a journey, and it's about learning from each individual experience.
Perfectly put, Alex. So how do you ultimately want to leave your mark?
You know, people ask me a lot what my superpower is. And I tell them that my superpower is helping you find yours. What gets me out of bed in the morning, what keeps me energized throughout the day, and what enables me to sleep at night is service. It's the beginning, it's the middle, and it's the end. And even in the midst of this week, when I've had all sorts of things raining down, you know, the possibility of saying goodbye to a beloved parent that I can't visit because of this disease, things happening with the supply chain on my book, what gets me out of bed is knowing that I can serve people. And so I would encourage people just to think about the greatest moments of joy you've experienced for the past week or two. Write those down. Write down the verbs. Write down what you're doing, because that's the key to what your mark is going to be. And for me, when I am serving, that is when I am in my flow and I feel the greatest joy. And that's what I hope my mark will be.
Incredible. Alex, it has been such a pleasure talking to you today. And the book is Ask for More. And I can't even imagine how many thousands of people, and I'm not saying just women, people, because any mm-hmm. single person can learn from this at any age. It's such a service what you're doing and what you're teaching. And thank you so much for coming on Leave Your Mark today.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Where can people find you? The book is obviously sold everywhere, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, etc.
Yes. So people can buy it wherever books are sold. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, bookshop.org is a great site to go to support independent bookstores. And let's think about all of the small business owners during this time. Please buy the hardcover. That's the best way you can show your support for this message. I will tell you, I also recorded the audiobook, and I did it from a closet in my home. So if you want to also get the Audible, you can hear a special note about how I created this book during coronavirus and read it to you, you know, even in the midst of these crazy circumstances. I'd also love for people to come find me on my website, which is alexcarterasks.com.
Perfect. And I would love to know your oxygen level in the closet when you recorded your audiobook, because that sounds like a nightmare.
You know, it actually was terrifying. And then it was so much fun because it was kind of a symbol of what we are all doing right now.
Yeah, you know, it's true.
Even in the midst of a pandemic, we can pivot, we can adapt, and we can find a way through. You know, yeah. And who gets to say that they recorded their audiobook in a closet? How cool is that?
It is cool. I mean, listen, I did a podcast last week in my car.
We're all doing
I can totally relate. My closet is too small and too claustrophobic. Alex, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure. Thanks so much for listening to Leave Your Mark, the podcast. If you want more career advice, be sure to pick up my best-selling book, Leave Your Mark. If you want to subscribe to my career advice newsletter, Blackboard, you can do so on alizalicht.com. Be sure to follow me on Instagram at alizalichtxo or reach out on Twitter at alizalicht. And just remember this, if change doesn't hurt a little, it's not change. Keep on rocking.